Welcome to Rights Watch, a program about human rights around the world from Human Rights Watch. I'm Jesse Graham. This is the show for the week of April 13th. Today we're talking about the violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Since 1998, more than 5 million people have died in Congo's conflict.
Why is it not on the front pages of our newspapers? Why is it not on the evening news every single day?
That's Annika von Woudenberg. She's a researcher for Human Rights Watch and an expert on Congo. We'll talk to her later in the show. But first, we'll hear an audio diary that Annika recorded during a recent trip to Congo. In the days before and after Christmas, a rebel group called the Lord's Resistance Army attacked Congolese villages. They killed at least 865 civilians and abducted more than 160 children. Many of the killings happened during three simultaneous attacks on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. Annika von Woudenberg visited the villages where the killings took place. She begins in the village of Batande.
We have come to Batande, a place where a massacre took place on Christmas Day, the 25th of December. And we have arrived here with a delegation of motorcycles and local witnesses about 3 weeks after the massacre has taken place. And I am here with some of the local witnesses who helped to bury the bodies and who saw what happened. We believe at least 65 people were killed, but possibly more. But I now just want to ask one person who was here with me exactly what he saw.
The LRA surrounded the chapel. They were tying people up. They made everyone take off all of their clothes, except their underwear.
So we are now going to the place where Papa Isidore found the bodies of the people from the church who were taken just a little distance away, about 50 meters, to a place where they were killed, where they were tied up, had their heads smashed with bats, and each one after the other, men, women, children, even young babies, killed in one day. Donc dites-nous, qu'est-ce que vous avez trouvé, Papa Isidore?
I was hiding nearby and I saw how they beat people. They crush their head until their brain come out. They kill my wife. They made her take off all of her clothes except her skirt and they killed her. She was 68 years old. They killed my whole family. I am the only one left.
So also earlier today, Papa Isidore showed us the grave where his wife was buried along with six other people just on the other side of the river from here in this very small town. This was an incredibly horrific massacre. We are now trying to collect some of the evidence that is still here, including some of the bats, big sticks, big branches that they used to kill people, which are still covered in blood, and also some of the clothes of the victims that still remain. As well as some of the cords, some of the ropes that were used to tie people up, including some of the rubber cords from bicycles, small cords. Apparently people were tied up with their clothes, sometimes their shirts. We also have some of the boots here, a burnt boot of someone from the LRA. And we will also take with us back to Doruma as just evidence of information we found, some of the bats covered with blood, in the hope that someday there can be justice. We have come to the town of Faraje, where also on Christmas Day there was a horrific massacre. At least 140 people were killed when the LRA entered on the outskirts of town and started killing silently before coming into the center of town. We can see the destruction all around us. Houses are burned, their roofs are gone. There's hardly anyone still living here. This was wanton destruction. They burned on both sides of the road, nearly destroying this suburb, this heavily populated suburb, just on the outskirts of Faraje. We have come to Aligi, where the LRA first entered. And in fact, where they found a person here who became their guide and who they forced to show them how they needed to enter town and which way they needed to go. I'm here with a witness who was here that day, who's going to explain what happened. Donc dites-nous un peu comment ça s'était arrivé. Ça a commencé comment?
Ils ont commencé par tuer les gens. Donc je vais vous montrer l'air.
They started by killing people. I will show you where they are buried and where they died.
Qu'ils ont eu la mort.
Donc maintenant, vous allez nous amener dans les endroits où les gens étaient tués.
Si, si.
So again, just a little further up on the road, we are being told this is where the school inspector lived. I'm approaching just a small house. In fact, one of the few of the ones that hasn't been burned. But it was here that he was killed. Donc ici, c'était sa maison. Oui. Mais c'était ici où il était tué.
Oui, ici.
C'est toujours le bâton qu'ils ont utilisé.
Si.
Yeah, we can still see here one of the bats, one of the big sticks actually that was used with blood on it. It's just lying beside the house. One of the sticks that was used to beat him on the head. Et lui, son nom, c'était comment?
Singakwi Kazmir.
Et là, à côté, c'est quoi?
Bon, c'est des tombes là.
Les anciens
tombes. Les anciens tombes, okay. Oui.
Still following this trail going into the center of town, we'll continue seeing just what numbers of people have died on the way into Aligi and where it goes from here. We're now in the center of town where we can see even more destruction around us. The doctor's house burned with his body inside and that of his child. The local administrator's house also attacked. Also, she was taken and to this day they don't know where she is. Further destruction in the marketplace. In fact, it was here that people were having a Christmas concert on the afternoon of Christmas Day when the LRA came in and attacked. In the central square, hundreds of people were gathered, many of them, of course, children, to watch what was happening during the Christmas concert. And the LRA came in, initially pretending to be friendly, surrounded them, abducted hundreds of the children. There's now a list of about 143 children that were taken, many of them between the ages of 9 and 15. And then they looted and burned the marketplace. And I'm just walking through the market now, and there's not much of it left. There's burned houses everywhere, destruction. And now there's only one local marketer who has taken the courage to come back. But for many people, this remains a ghost town. We now know, after our research here, that about 150 people died. But of course, the count goes up every day as new bodies are discovered and as the information starts to trickle in about just what happened in the town of Faraj.
That was Annika von Woudenberg reporting from Northern Congo for Human Rights Watch. I interviewed Annika during her recent visit to New York. So Annika, tell me a little bit more about what we just heard. You've talked to many, many more victims during your trip. What was the most surprising thing that you found?
I've been documenting human rights abuses in Congo for more than 10 years. I was surprised at the silent ferocity of these attacks. So efficient, so targeted to kill. I mean, really what the Lord's Resistance Army were doing were carrying out killing raids in order to maximize the number of civilians that they killed. They wanted to send a sign that they were against the attacks that had just taken place against them.
Let's pull back and talk a little bit about that. The Lord's Resistance Army is a rebel group from Uganda. How did they end up in Congo?
Well, the Lord's Resistance Army have been operating against civilians, of course, initially in northern Uganda and then in southern Sudan for more than 20 years. They arrived in Congo in late 2005 when they were effectively kicked out of Uganda and have set up camp now in one of the main national parks in northern Congo. They have been there since late 2005, but they tended not to target Congolese civilians. That changed dramatically in September 2008, when the leader of that group, Joseph Kony, decided to start attacks on Congolese civilians. And since then, it's been Congolese people paying the price.
And the brutality that we heard about, is that typical of the LRA, the kidnappings, but also the beatings? They actually beat people to death.
They beat people to death by crushing their skulls with axes, machetes and large wooden bats. The Lord's Resistance Army have been a very brutal armed group for many years now. So certainly the behaviour in Congo was not unique. But this time they were very efficient, and this was one of the worst attacks the LRA have ever carried out.
Some of the other audio that you gathered, you actually asked people about the LRA, what they thought of them and what they thought should happen to them. Can you tell us a little bit about that, about what the people of Congo who experience these attacks want to happen?
Most of the people we spoke to in Congo want to see an end to the LRA. They want this problem finished. They want it dealt with. They don't understand why people are attacking them. They don't understand why the Lord's Resistance Army has a problem with them.
Well, why do they? I mean, it is hard to understand. Why does this group attack people in this brutal way? What do they want?
I think it's not very clear. What we do know is that these attacks were reprisal attacks that came following a military operation that started against the Lord's Resistance Army on the 14th of December. This is when the Ugandan and Congolese governments together decided to launch a military operation to try and arrest and neutralize the Lord's Resistance Army.
And there was some U.S. involvement in that as well?
Well, certainly from what Human Rights Watch have documented, indeed, this was a military operation supported with intelligence, logistics and financial backing from the United States. The involvement from the United States, of course, is important because there had been peace talks going on with the LRA for many years. It was clear that this was these were talks that were not going anywhere. So the United States, certainly as one of the countries, decided that there needed to be an alternative plan should the Lord's Resistance Army not sign the peace accords. Once Joseph Kony, the leader of the LRA, did not turn up, the military operation was launched, and it had deadly consequences for Congolese civilians. That certainly was not, of course, the intended objective of the operation, but little was done during the planning to ensure that should the target be missed on the first strike, and they did miss, little was done to put in place protection for civilians, and that's how the town of Batunde was attacked and numerous other villages and towns. Certainly one of the tactics that the Lord's Resistance Army has used consistently in its 20-year history is when they are attacked, they don't attack those who are attacking them, like the Congolese military or like the Ugandan military. They turn on the most defenseless people. They turn on civilians, men, women, children, babies. It doesn't matter who they are. They consider them the legitimate target.
And the leader of the Lord's Resistance Army, that's Joseph Kony, and other leaders of the rebel group are indicted by the International Criminal Court. What do you think of that, and how is that affecting the violence that we've seen recently from the group?
The International Criminal Court have put out arrest warrants, initially against five of the top leadership of the LRA for the serious crimes that they committed in northern Uganda. Now, two of those individuals have since died, so three remain. All three of them are in northern Congo. And it's clear that somebody needs to come in and arrest them. Somebody needs to ensure that these are individuals who will one day see justice.
And the Congolese government has done that in the past. They've had rebel leaders that were indicted by the International Criminal Court, and they have gone in and gotten them, correct?
That's right. The Congolese government, in fact, has been one of the most cooperative nations with the International Criminal Court. They have transferred three other Congolese warlords to The Hague, and a fourth other Congolese individual was arrested in Europe. But the Lord's Resistance Army leaders, of course, have been very hard to catch. They are in a very remote part of northern Congo where there's hardly any police force. So the question of who would arrest them became a critical component. And that's why the Ugandan army decided to launch a military operation jointly with the Congolese and the Sudanese army to now finally attempt to apprehend the leadership of the LRA.
Did the people of northern Congo who you spoke to, did they know about the International Criminal Court's warrants for the arrest of Joseph Kony? Were they talking about justice, some kind of justice?
The people of northern Congo who I met on this mission that we did were desperate, of course, for justice. Justice is something that is strongly felt in Congolese culture. They very much believe if something has been done against them, that those responsible for those abuses must be held to account. And recently there was a study done by human rights experts on what Congolese people felt about justice and felt about the atrocities. And every single time the answer that came is, we want justice. We
We want to see those who killed, who raped, who tortured, who looted. We want to see them behind bars, and we want to see them punished.
And do they see the International Criminal Court as an appropriate body to punish people or to try people?
What's interesting is that many people in Congo see the International Criminal Court as their only hope. They are desperate to have justice done, and they have seen that the court has started investigations in northeastern Congo in a place called Ituri. And they have seen, for the first time ever, that individuals are being arrested and are being held to account.
Well, it's actually the first place that the ICC, the International Criminal Court, is focusing on for a trial, correct?
That's right. So the first ever case, the first ever trial, started on January 26th. It took place in The Hague, but it was of a Congolese warlord who had committed horrific atrocities in the town of Ituri. And Human Rights Watch was actually physically present the day that the trial opened. I personally was in Bunia watching justice unfold. And I saw how people were desperate to see it happen. They were excited. They were scared. They were curious. When we started to see the images coming in from The Hague. But what I saw were people sitting on the edge of their seats, gripped with what was happening in this courtroom in The Hague, and they were seeing justice unfold. And that's what so many of them want. Those who've been victims of the LRA, of course, want to go back home. They want to see their families protected, but they also want to see an end to this armed group, and they want to see the leadership of the LRA arrested and behind bars.
And what are those people doing now? Are they afraid that they'll be attacked again?
It is so sad to be in northern Congo today. People are terrified of ongoing attacks by the Lord's Resistance Army. When we were in the town of Daruma, which itself had not been attacked, but 13 villages around it had been attacked, people were gathered there, very scared. They were unsure if they could go back home. And what really struck me, actually, is people were scared to be together in large groups. They were scared to go to church. They were scared to do communities' activities together. Because they said it was when we were together, when we had gathered together for Christmas lunch, when we had gathered together for a Christmas concert, that's when the Lord's Resistance Army attacked us. They didn't want to get together anymore, thinking maybe we'll be attacked again. And I find that very distressing and very sad for the people who live in this area.
And of course, this isn't the only place in Congo right now that is in danger, that is in conflict. You've also recently been to the region called the Kivus, is that correct, where there's also ongoing conflict?
The sad reality is that there continues to be fighting and conflict throughout huge stretches of eastern Congo. So in the very north by the Lord's Resistance Army, in another place in northeastern Congo called Ituri, where some of the armed groups still carry out horrific atrocities. But most recently, north and south Kivu, the two provinces bordering Rwanda, have been incredibly volatile. And we are seeing more than 22 armed groups operating there, continuing to kill, to rape, to abduct, to, of course, use children in their ranks. And the people of eastern Congo continue to be the ones paying the price for the lack of justice and for continued bad governance by the government of Congo. We continue to see the after effects of the 1994 genocide. And always when it's
in Rwanda, that is.
The 1994 genocide in Rwanda. And whenever we see this conflict in eastern Congo, whenever we see them picking up weapons and shooting, it's the people of eastern Congo who pay the price.
Before we started the interview, we were talking a little bit about why Americans or why people around the world don't know more about Congo, considering that we're talking about 5 million people killed since 1998. Why? Why don't we know more about this? And why don't people care?
It is the question I ask myself all the time. Why is it that 5 million people dead since 1998 in the deadliest war in the world, why is it not on the front pages of our newspapers? Why is it not on the evening news every single day? I don't have a good answer to that. I think partly it's because people believe that maybe in Africa, these kinds of things happen, that it's okay, that they're not connected to this. But actually, they are. Part of the reason why the war continues in Congo is its rich natural resources. Congo has every mineral under the sun: gold, diamonds, copper, cobalt, timber, oil, uranium, you name it. Congo has it. And of course, these are not commodities bought by Congolese people. They're bought by people in the West. They're bought by people in Europe, in the United States, and in other places.
Everywhere now.
And now everywhere. In our globalized world, we are connected to Congo. We should be much more aware what we as consumers are buying. This does come from someplace. And in this particular case, it comes from Congo, where people suffer, where they're abused because of this rich natural wealth. And it's time, I think, that we ourselves take responsibility for that. And we should care when this kind of thing happens, when so many have died.
And you told me you were in Los Angeles yesterday talking to some high school kids about this. What did you tell them about what you do and how they can engage with it, I guess?
Well, one of the things, of course, that I find striking is I can come to the United States and talk to high school students, explain to them what's going on in Congo. I wouldn't be able to do that in Congo because there wouldn't be very many students in a classroom. You know, most high schools are not functioning, especially in Eastern Congo. And I also reminded them, in fact, I split them up into three different groups. And I said, if you were high school students in Congo, one third of you would now be children in an armed group. You would be carrying weapons. You would be fighting. The other group, the other third, probably would have all been raped, especially the women and girls, or especially the teenagers in this particular group. And the other third would probably all have been forced to run from their homes, to sleep rough, to not be in their homes at night, to be cowering in fear in the forests or elsewhere. And that's the reality. And I think they were somewhat shocked by that. But that is indeed what we see. They're lucky to be where they are. They're lucky to have been born in places where they're born. And I think, you know, I was reminding them that they should care about what happens in a place like Congo.
Did they ask you what they could do? What did they ask you?
They did. And they, in fact, were very enthusiastic about trying to help. So one of the things, especially here in the United States, that I was encouraging them to do, of course, is to write to their legislators, to write to President Obama, to write to Hillary Clinton, to say actually that the United States should appoint a special envoy for the Great Lakes region of Africa to ensure that Washington is more engaged on these issues and to ensure that Washington becomes part of the answers, helps to find solutions to these problems. But I was also saying to them, encourage your government to sign up to the International Criminal Court. Ensure that the United States is on the side of those who want justice. Stand shoulder to shoulder with Congolese people who desperately want to see those who are responsible for these abuses arrested and held to account.
We're going to have to end it there. Thank you so much, Annika.
Thank you.
For more about Human Rights Watch's work in Congo and around the world, please visit hrw.org. That includes multimedia features we've produced with Annika, audio slideshows, videos, and even a political cartoon about repression in Congo.
Thanks for listening to Rights Watch. I'm Jesse Graham.